Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the weather and climate with our weather guys. Well, our weather guy for the moment, Steve Eckerman, with us right now, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. John Martin will be with us. He's probably
teaching
class until noon. He's a professor and chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. So if you have some questions about the weather or climate, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you monitor those forecasts. Do you plan things out around them or just take the weather as it comes? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And we got warm temperatures out there.
Yeah, it's kind of weather I like, you know, where it's not too warm, though.
No.
You know, it's still probably in the 30s, although it may be getting up higher. And it's a little, the sun's trying to get out.
Sun's trying to get out, yeah.
It's kind of nice when the sun gets out.
I was watching a weather forecast this morning on television, and the weather person was saying that the temperatures are running 8, 9 degrees higher on average than normal.
Yeah, most of the state is for January 5 degrees above normal. So even though we had this recent cold air come out of the Arctic and engulf us, on average we're warmer than normal.
We're warm. Yeah. Email from Dennis. A question relating to Earth's magnetic field. Is that field made up of stuff? I.e., does the magnetic field have mass?
I don't think so, no. I mean, and if you think about it, it's like an energy field, or like a regular magnetics. It sets up an electromagnetic field, and unless you can convert that into mass via Einstein's equation, right, E equals MC squared, it is just a field, yeah.
Okay. Well, In the fall, you mentioned the launch of a new weather satellite. I think we talked about
it. Oh, right, yeah, the NPP.
And now NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have renamed it to honor a UW professor.
That's right.
Werner Summe.
Yep, to honor Werner Summe, the person known as the father of satellite meteorology. Because he, you know, while working with engineer Peyton over in engineering, developed the first instrument to observe Earth's energy budget. And it was the first instrument that looked back at Earth and made measurements of Earth. And then he went on to develop the spin scan camera, which is basically the fundamental instrument that led to the images we see every night on the evening news or when we go on the internet and look at satellite imagery. So he did a lot of things, as well as the software of how do you animate that stuff. So he's a real leader in the field, and NASA, with collaborations from NOAA, changed the name of the satellite, which was known as NPP, for the NPOS Preparatory Partnership or Program. And NPOS was another acronym, and that whole NPOS program was canceled. So the name made no sense. And so they decided to name it after Werner Summe by calling it the Summe NPP. But now NPP stands for the National Polar Orbiting Partnership.
There we go. Well, so Werner Summe was a meteorologist and an engineer?
Yeah, he was founder of the Space Science and Engineering Center, as well as founder and first director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, as well as a faculty member in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And that big 15-story building, I mean, he's one of the ones who made that building happen. He put Wisconsin on the map with regard to satellite meteorology.
Yeah, very, very cool. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. I'd love to hear from you. Well, we had a correction from Mike who says, you said the sun is trying to come out, but really it's the clouds need to get out of the way.
Oh, very true.
I wonder if Mike ever took a class from you and he's just getting back at
getting
you.
Back, right, yeah. Sun, that's true. At daylight time, the sun is always out. It's whether or not we could see it.
Oh, man. A listener wonders how helpful weather balloons still are in this age of weather satellites. First, can you tell us what both lower and higher tech forecasting instruments are actually measuring to give you good forecast data?
Oh, boy, that's a really good question.
We send those balloons up a couple times a day, don't they?
Yeah, every day at 0Z Greenwich time and 12Z. Everybody all over the globe sends them up, so they're all going up at the same time. And that data is primarily used in numerical weather prediction models as a way to initialize the model. So it kind of helps define what the upper atmosphere is at a particular time. And then from that, the forecasts take off. Now, the disadvantage is that, one, they only go up twice a day. Their advantage is that they provide very high resolution of the vertical structure of the atmosphere, which is very important for determining where very stable layers in the atmosphere are. And their disadvantage is that, you know, somebody's got to launch them, which means in the middle of the ocean, we don't have them unless there's a ship going by. So satellites help provide the global coverage. And from satellite observations from this new SUMI NPP, there are instruments on there that allow us to interpret the temperature and the moisture structure of the atmosphere. So their advantage is they could do it over the entire globe. The other advantage is we could do it every half hour if you're on a geostationary satellite. The disadvantage is that we don't have high spatial resolution in the vertical, so we don't have a lot of vertical detail. Models use both the balloon launches, which have temperature profilers on them, as well as the moisture measurement instruments, and the satellite instruments in terms of setting the initial conditions. So they're both very important, although some models prefer the satellites over the balloons, and other models prefer the balloons over the satellites.
Now, do the balloons, do they just go up and they're gone forever, or do they go up on a rope and come, you pull them back down, or what happens?
You fill them up with helium, and they're probably, when you first fill them up, they may be 8 feet in diameter or so.
Okay.
And then they take off vertically, and eventually, when they get up several tens of thousands of feet, they bust. And at that time, they're like the size of a house. So they really expand as the atmosphere becomes less dense. And then they break, and then the package that carries the instruments falls to the ground. And the package is very light. It's mostly covered in styrofoam. And if it hits the ground and you find one, there's an address where you can just drop it in the mailbox, and it gets mailed back to the National Weather Service, and they could reuse it. But as it turns out, most people either don't find them or find them and keep them.
they want them, right.
And apparently there are stories of people going into farmers' barns and finding a whole wall of them, because they're right downwind, and if you have a lot of property and it's open field, you have more of a chance to see this white thing laying in your field, I guess.
Oh, man. Well, William in Colfax has a question or comment for you, so let's go there. Hi, William.
Hi. I live in Colfax, and I've been gardening here for 25 years, and I've definitely noticed a change in the way the weather or the climate, however you want to say it, is changing. And I recently contacted our Senator Ron Johnson about these concerns, and he sent me a letter in which he states that man-made global warming is an unsettled science. World-renowned climate experts raise serious objections to the theories behind these claims. And he says that there is no certainty and certainly no scientific basis for these claims. And I'm really concerned about a U.S. senator and an influential person making these claims. When I've listened to you guys on the radio for years, and it seems to me that climate change is not, a debate as debatable as he claims, and he doesn't really name the world-renowned climate experts who have raised these serious concerns.
That's because there aren't any.
Well, that's my point. I guess.
It's a wrong statement, and I totally agree with you. This is not an unsettled science. If you go through, and people have done this, have looked at the referee journals, through peer review. And I'll tell you, peer review is not easy to get through.
No.
Either in the professional world or even with our students. When we have our students mark other students' grades, they're a lot tougher than I am because people who take that very seriously. You don't find publications that say, global warming is not caused by humans. It's just not in there. It is very likely that humans are playing the role in terms of, and very likely phrase is a phrase that's been debated about by hundreds of scientists in terms of what does that mean. And not only is it the data that's demonstrating it, but it's also the physics. It's what we would expect our carbon emissions from fossil fuel burning would do to the Earth's atmosphere. So, yeah, I get very disappointed, too, because, this is a serious thing. And you can't, you can either ignore it or we could do something about it. And if you want to ignore it, that's fine. But let's not, you know, say the science is unsettled or it isn't happening, because that's not the way it's being projected. And he's clearly getting poor advice from somebody.
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to say was that in this letter, he claims that, in order for us to sort of address this issue, it would cause, irreparable harm to the American economy. And I think that it actually could be an economic opportunity by not just ignoring this issue, but addressing the issue and all the ways that we need to change things and address things. So I think it could be seen as an economic opportunity, and I don't agree with his statement that it would be an economic disaster to acknowledge the fact that it's happening.
And, I'll tell you, that's what I would like to see, is the debate about whether or not politically we're going to do something because it's economically or socially responsible or whatever. Let's get to that stage and start talking about that, and try and let's stop trying to avoid it by saying it's not occurring. Because by saying it's not occurring, you never enter into that debate. And that's just crazy.
I agree. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And John Martin joins us.
Hey, guys.
That was class.
It was good. It was good.
Yeah, you ran over here, didn't you?
Sounded like your conversation was very much more exciting.
Well, I tell you what. Now that you're here, we can take a look at the news. We'll take a break.
All right. Yes,
we can do that.
I have that effect on groups.
Right. We'll collect ourselves here. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor and chair of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, with us now. And on into the future here, the near future, but we're going to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with our guests. Taking a look at weather and climate today with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, professor of atmospheric sciences, John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, in the studio with us. And you can join in with a question. You got a weather question or climate question? The number 1-800-642-1234. Also, post on my Facebook page if you want. Go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. We have a question from Jackie, who wonders, is climate change increasing cloudiness and decreasing sunniness in Wisconsin or across the country?
That's a really good question that we're trying to answer these days with our satellite observations.
Yeah.
Cloud cover is really variable. And so because it's so variable, you really need a long record to determine what's happening with the cloud covers. And when we look at global cloud cover in particular, we really only have those observations during the satellite era, which would be like the last 30 years or so.
Yeah, the record's pretty short. And I'm not sure that people have a good sense of what they're looking for in the record either. Is that right? I mean, I'm not in that field, but
yeah.
How do you measure it? How do you put statistics on cloudiness because it is so variable?
It's so variable, right.
It's a tricky question.
And the impact on the weather is also going to be dependent on how high the cloud is and how thick it is.
Yeah,
So you can have, you could have basically countering effects, by having a high thin cirrus and then having the same amount or relative amount of low thick strato cloud. And they'll kind of offset each other in terms of their impact.
On Facebook, Steve wonders if you would comment or explain cycle 25 and if you believe cycle 25 will, in fact, cool the Earth to the same mini ice ages in the 18th century. Are you guys familiar with something called...
I don't know what cycle 25 is. No.
I'm not sure either, although it sounds like... look at the solar output is always changing. It's got a 22-year cycle, although its energy output is an 11-year cycle. And they call those... They number those cycles. I don't know if that would cycle 25 would go back to the 18th century. I thought they were more like you know, what cycle are we currently in?
Mm. Okay.
But the output of the solar, in terms of particularly recent warming that we are observing, it's not correlated with that.
Okay.
When you look at, you know, 600,000 years of our climate on Earth, then we see variations because of mostly how the Earth changes its orbit around the sun.
Let's turn to Carl in Wilmette. Thank you for calling, Carl. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, I'm interested in the global warming question, and I agree that people are affecting it. But there is also global warming going on Mars. The ice caps have been shrinking for years. Mm. You know, so there is a solar effect also.
Well, the ice caps on Mars shrink and then come back. It's a seasonal cycle.
But it's been getting more.
Well, I think that's because our observations are better. So we're not in a position to say that things are substantially different in the Martian atmosphere today than they were even 50 years ago. We had no measurements at all 50 years ago, and we've only had a scintilla of measurements since about 1976. So it's really we're not armed with the observations we need to make statements like that and really support them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Good comment. Daniel in Rice Lake. Hello.
Hello. A month ago, I passed over the Rio Grande in New Mexico. It was dust from bank to bank, which I'd never seen before. In Arkansas, they said they'd had no snow nor freezing rain this winter. And back up north, there's very little snow accumulation, which I find eerie. How severe are the signs of drought in the United States?
Well, in the Texas area, and in that kind of southwest area, the drought's been really severe.
Yeah, very bad.
And that would explain some recent dust storm events that we've been saying. So as it gets really dry and vegetation begins to die off, then soil becomes more exposed and winds can pick that soil up and move it. Mm. Yeah.
And I don't know about the rest of the country right now. I often look at the drought severity index. There's a place you can find it on the web. It's one of the NOAA websites. I haven't seen it recently. But I know that the biggest area of concern was the desert southwest, especially southwest Texas, was just devastated this fall and summer.
Yeah.
It was horribly bad there. I can't recall if there's any place else that's really in that kind of state.
Kind of the southeast is also.
Is that right?
A little bit, but not as bad as where the Texas area is. And, of course, Texas just got creamed by a lot of precipitation, at least the eastern Texas. I don't know how far west
that
went.
It doesn't always help. You know, it has to come back at a reasonable pace, because otherwise it runs right off the ground that's rock solid because
that's
of all
right.
the drying.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you for calling. Charlie in Green Bay, on to you. Hi, Charlie.
How you doing?
Good.
Hey, question about Wisconsin fishing waters. We're seeing more smallmouth and largemouth bass, where it seemed like years ago we'd get more walleyes in northern Wisconsin. Is this inevitable with global warming that we're going to see more bass and a walleye reduction? Could you maybe comment on that?
Do the walleye like colder water?
I believe so. Yeah. Bass are more adept, I believe.
Yeah, that's what I would. I mean, where I go fishing, I mostly always get bass, and I never get walleye except early in the spring.
Because in the south, everybody fishes bass.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. I think some of that's a result of Department of Natural Resources
stocking
programs too.
Yeah.
But they may be responding now to average water temperatures, because Steve hits a really important point. That's the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. WICCI has its own website, WICCI. And one of the things that they've done there is they partner with our department, with the Nelson Institute, with other departments on campus, as well as the Department of Natural Resources and Tourism. And so there are some really focused studies on what the impacts of a half degree temperature change in the water will be by limnologists and so on the distribution of fish species. So these kinds of things, these things really are being not only observed but being studied, and we're trying to make guesses about what will be true 20 or 5 or 30 or 50 years from now to try and mitigate against these changes and plan for them.
Okay. Yep. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Chris in Beaver Dam, on to you. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I don't disbelieve the global warming climate change question. I just don't believe that it's going to have the dramatic impact that some of the doom and gloom predictions have created. So my question is, if I'm driving down the highway now creating some carbon emissions, I'm also looking at a median. that's just you know, scrub grasses. Why can't we plant a high, fast growing or high carbon pulling species everywhere we go, where we're going to release carbon? You know, why can't this highway median be filled with evergreens instead of grasses that aren't doing anything right now? You know, on every turn, you know, the big on ramp sections of land that aren't anything but scrub grasses should have a windmill in them, instead of having a fight about how, where to put the windmills. Put the windmills where there's not going to be anything anyway.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it is. and that's what, and a lot of people are now looking at that in terms of how do you mitigate it. And as you're pointing out, it's really a function of where you live and where you're looking in terms of what you can do to kind of offset some of the impacts. And changing planting zones is one way to go it. The thing to remember, though, is that what plants do is store the carbon dioxide. And as soon as they die or burn off, you know, if they get hit by lightning and the median does burn up, then, you know, that carbon dioxide or some of that carbon dioxide will get back into the atmosphere.
Gets released.
But, yeah, that's a good idea. I haven't heard anybody really talking about changing the medium. I'd like to see more wildflowers in the median so it's pretty as we drive down those highways, too. And we'd do the same thing.
And on the gloom and doom issue, I think, you know, there's more than a nugget of truth there. I think there are some who cling to probably the worst of the several scenarios and trumpet those as if they're as likely or the most likely scenario. And it's probably not a good thing to try and get people on board about thinking about this issue seriously. However, those are possibilities. I think they're probably the lower probability possibilities. But even if we're just talking about with the fish, even a half a degree or 1 degree Celsius change in the temperature of the Iron River or something is going to change the fish that are there. And if you're making your living on tourism up there, it sounds like a really small change, but it's going to totally change your life. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't know where the line is for gloom and doom and in really serious displacement. It's somewhere, but it's probably closer to the reality than the worst case scenarios.
It depends on probably how you make your livelihood.
I think so,
the impact is on your region.
I think so.
Region.
John in Fall Creek, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, I'm last Friday. There was Science Friday was on, and the first section, which I tuned in a little late on, it sounded like there was a solar event going on in real time. And they were talking about, in fact, one of the scientists who was following it said the proton storm was about to hit Earth about 1:30, which is when they were done with their thing. I'm wondering if your satellites got any was there any malfunction? Apparently, there was the X-ray burst was there, but we missed the coronal mass ejection. It just kind of missed us.
Yeah, and you know, there was a lot of talk about that solar storm, which was, I think, the biggest one that they had seen since 2005. But as you're pointing out, most of us missed us was a good thing. So the impact on satellite communications and particularly the weather satellites, there really wasn't any impact, which is great. I also noticed that around Thursday and even Friday, they were changing airplane pathways, particularly those that go over the North Pole. Because if that high energy gets to the North Pole and you're up at that altitude, then you get that radiation as passengers and pilots. And in fact, one of my planes early in the month, I was supposed to be coming home on Thursday or Wednesday night, and they kept delaying it and changing when it was going to leave. And I think it was because they weren't sure what this solar storm was going to do. And in the end, we just left at our normal time. It was really kind of odd. But yeah, pilots are limited how many times they can fly over the North Pole. Even in non-solar storm days, because when you get that high, you're exposed to this radiation from the sun that's being caught up in the magnetic fields and being brought down on the two poles.
Mm. Yeah, they they brought up the aurora event of 1859.
Oh, okay.
Uh, we, which apparently was quite, I mean, aurora visible during the day is...
It's pretty rare. Well, yeah, very rare.
Very rare.
Wow.
Very impressive.
Yeah. But that's what I was hoping for with this storm, is that we'd be able to see the northern lights in our latitude belt, but it didn't happen.
Didn't happen. Yeah. Thank you, John, very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And Christy and Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Christy.
Hi. I am wondering, I just got done reading a book called Fractal Time, and I've kind of really been focusing on that 2012 thing. What does happen, what will happen, if the poles do shift, when the alignment of the planets happens? What will our weather become here? Should we be expecting something like, you know, like 2012, the movie? Or, I mean, I'm sure that some huge cataclysmic things are going to happen. But, I mean, how could we prepare for that, or should we just kind of let it happen?
Yeah, I'm not sure we can do much preparation. I mean, I'm assuming, Lisa, the way that I'm interpreting your question is, you know, geomagnetic poles flip around naturally.
Right. Right.
And we're supposed to be entering a period at some point where they're going to flip around again. Its impact on the weather, I don't think, is going to do anything.
Yeah, that's correct.
Communications, it might, or in terms of the northern lights, depending on where the poles end up, might influence us. But
yeah, and I think your compass probably needs to be replaced.
And the compass was, that's right, that's a good point.
To the extent that a GPS uses it, I don't think they do, though. They probably instead use, satellites
and things like that. Right?
Yeah, but a compass would be completely wrong if the poles switched. But the weather has no... There's nothing in the equations of motion governing the atmosphere that references magnetism, so it won't have any impact.
Yeah.
So what would happen? What would happen if those things switch? What are we going to be looking at?
Well,
I mean, if you say that our weather isn't switching, I mean, it's already switching.
Yeah, but not because of that. So you're asking, is it going to be because of magnetic change? And it won't be that, that's for sure.
Right, but what would be the final outcome of that?
Of the magnetic shift?
Yes.
I think you'd have to reevaluate navigational equipment and things like that. If you're on a boat, you better make sure your compass has been fixed and so on. But really, those are communications based on satellite communication from space will probably be affected, as Steve said, but not the weather.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're not going to see anything like the day after tomorrow.
No.
Just it'll just be a cycle that it'll go through.
Yeah, without much effect. No effect at all on the weather. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. There you go.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
That's one good thing.
Yeah, right.
Warren in Green Bay, on to you now. Let's see if I can get you on here. Hi, Warren.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for the call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask the weather gentleman about the formation of snow crystals. I read in a book many years ago that snow is formed by a process called deposition, which is the opposite of sublimation. In other words, the vapor in the atmosphere changes directly to a solid crystal. Does that sound correct to them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one way that you can form ice in clouds. Is exactly right.
Okay, and the other thing, the second part of that, I was also under the impression that snow requires a dust or dirt particle, or maybe a smog particle, or something like that, in the atmosphere. Is that also true? In other words, if just theoretically speaking, if the atmosphere were perfectly clean, you would not have snow, because snow requires some particle to kind of glom onto. Does that sound reasonable?
No, you would still have snow. So you could have what we call homogeneous nucleation, and nucleation is the beginning.
Mm.
But that's when water vapor will just condense and form an ice crystal. But that generally does not occur until you get to temperatures colder than minus 40 degrees Celsius, which happens to be minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, and that's asking a lot in our atmosphere.
You got to get up pretty high to do that.
Yeah.
So what the particles do is it makes it easier for a snow crystal to form, or even a liquid water drop. So it's a lot easier for things to condense or deposit onto things that already exist, as opposed to, you know, condensing and coming together without any agent to begin it.
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to clarify that.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I was reading something in one of my daughter's books about snowflakes, and the largest snowflake on record.
The size of a plate. So I was like, am I wrong? Or what
no,
did she say?
It was 15 inches across.
15 inches, right. Okay.
Yeah, it's one of those giant aggregates probably.
Yeah.
Because individual flakes, you pick it apart, you can find all the ones that are connected, like, you know, the antlers of elk or something when they fight. They all get connected and turn into what's called an aggregate, and they can be really big. I've seen them the size of pigeons in Seattle.
Wow.
But, yeah, really big.
I've seen half dollars, and I thought that was big.
It is. It still is.
A pigeon.
Well, I might be exaggerating. Right. I'm prone to that. But they were huge. But that's probably the kind of thing.
But would they be coming down like that? You know,
they would be just floating down as a
and
big,
collecting everything in their path as they come. That's how they get a little bit bigger and bigger and bigger. It's probably what happens.
Wow. And we see them around here. I mean, it's not uncommon to see quarter size.
Right.
And when they hit the sidewalk, they just break apart and float away.
It is less common here than any place else I've ever lived. And the reason, I think, is because when it snows here, it's usually well below freezing. The days where we get snow with the temperatures hovering around 32 Fahrenheit is so much lower in Madison than it is in Boston or in Seattle.
Yeah.
A huge difference. And that's one of the conditions you need to get those giant aggregate flakes.
That almost hurt getting hit by
it. I know.
I'd
like
love to see
like
a play
snowball
a
fight with
or,
nature.
Yeah, it's like
or a 10 incher. That'd be fun to see. Bill in Sun Prairie, it's on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good program. Thanks. I've seen some maps that show sea level rising, and it's pretty ominous for the state of Florida.
Yeah.
It seems like the coastline would almost go totally inland. And my daughter and her three children, my grandchildren, are seriously considering moving down there. So my question is, should I warn them not to buy any property along the coast? And if so, is there any guess you can take on the timeline when that might occur, next 25 years, 50 years, 100 years?
A lot of times those projections are going out 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think personally there are two reasons why I wouldn't buy property on Florida coastline. One is the long-term rise in sea level, which is going to happen as the earth warms up. It's a matter of how much it's going to rise and whether or not the government's willing to invest money to mitigate that, you know, by building things like seawalls. And the other shorter-term concern is hurricanes.
Yeah, right. That's an annual threat. So.
Yeah. So, I'd be more, to be honest, be more worried about getting hit by those and what that impact would be.
I think the average height above sea level of Florida is 13 meters.
So wow.
So 40 feet.
Yeah, that's
there's places that are a little bit higher than that, and many places are much less than that.
Yeah.
It's a little sand spit.
So if you're in the middle of Florida, you're probably okay.
Probably better than you would be near the coast, but I don't know how much better. I don't really know the topography that well of the state.
It's pretty flat up there.
Yeah. I think far northeast Florida, west of Jacksonville, is maybe got a little bit of the foothills of the, not foothills, but the base of the Appalachians. That might be the highest elevations, maybe tens of meters high or something like that.
Yeah, and you get into Orlando, that area,
that's flat. That's old swamp. Flat.
That's old swamp.
Yeah.
Of course, in today's economy, if she has a job and that's why she's moving, then, you know, that's just... That's important.
Yeah.
So you might expect a real estate crash, even worse than it is, along the coast sometime in the next 25, 50 years then. Huh?
Yeah, it'd be a different kind of man-made crash this time. That's right. Yeah, that's right. I think that's a possibility. Yeah.
So.
And I assume also that the insurance rates would be going higher and higher with the flood risk and also the hurricane risk.
Yeah, they start out high because of the hurricane risk, as Steve points out. I mean, that's really the first order threat, I think, when somebody looks at buying property insurance on the coast of Florida.
We're talking about a tremendous amount of very high-end real estate along the coast as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, all the high-rise condominiums, I mean, multi-million-dollar properties.
Mm-hmm. That's
And that's the flip side of the coin, I think, is, you know, human behavior. I mean, we like to have this view of the water, right? I mean, it's kind of a nice view to have.
Yep.
So even though all these risks go up and insurance goes up, it's likely that people are going to continue to buy there unless they're told not to.
Yep.
Fascinating human psychology.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
It surely is.
Thanks a lot. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Thursday's Groundhog Day.
John loves Groundhog. That's John's favorite holiday.
Favorite day. That and the day that the almanac is released.
That's right.
is is Jimmy going to see a shadow on Thursday?
I can't remember, and I don't care. I have to tell you.
Actually, I thought we were going to get a prediction out of John for the furry
animal.
Last
year, there was a huge storm. On,
was there?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
That was our biggest
Groundhog Day
year.
Storm. Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
I don't think we're going to get that. But.
No, we are not. It's going to be a nice warm week, actually. Much higher than normal, above normal temperatures. I can't remember if Thursday's the cloudy, drizzly day or not. I think that it might be.
Well, you will be back the last Monday of next month, right?
Yes.
That's right. That's what the hog is predicting.
Yeah, that's right.
That we can predict. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, they will be back. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.